We're continuing our series, and we'll be concluding it this morning on the subject of faith. It's a great privilege to be with you in this worship hour and to enjoy your strength and your encouragement in your singing, in the prayers, and in gathering around the table. I'm glad to be back with you. Seems like I've been gone a good while, but really I haven't. But being absent last Sunday or away from the pulpit makes me feel like either you've been gone or I've been gone one. What do you call a person that's always talking about football? Football fan, don't you? Or basketball, you call them a basketball fan. What do you call a person that's always talking about racing cars? You call him a racing enthusiast. What do you call a person that's always talking about health foods? You call him a health food nut. I apologize, but you know, that's just what they call them. I've got people in my family like that. What do you call people that are always talking about Texas? You call them a big mouth Texan. But you know, all of these people have something in common. They're all completely sold on their particular interest. They're really captivated, and as a result, they've been captured, and then they've been catapulted into public eye by their always talking about this thing that they believe in so strongly. And their enthusiastic testimonials that you hear repeatedly and that you hear without invitation and that you hear almost without end, these unsolicited testimonials are not the result of someone saying, now we need to get out there and talk up football, or we need to get out there and talk up racing, or talk up health foods. That's not the cause of their speaking. The cause of their speaking is an inner fire. It's a deep conviction. These people have been captured and captivated by something that they have become so absorbed in that they genuinely believe that it's true. They genuinely are enthralled by the power of it. And having been so captured by it, they then become the proponents of it. And that's just as natural as day following night. And therefore, we conclude that just as people are going to invest in what they believe in, people are also going to talk about what they believe in. And you can no more shut them up than you can stop the sun from shining. You can no more shut them up than you can stop a tea kettle from either whistling or exploding. As long as that fire is underneath it, it's going to do one of the two. It will either whistle or it will explode. Now, today we're going to be mentioning the particular aspect of talking that pertains to the gospel of Jesus Christ. This particular principle that the believer is going to speak is particularly and peculiarly true regarding those people who are believers in Jesus Christ. Now, this is true because of the uniqueness of Jesus, because of the surpassing worth that Jesus Christ presents and provides for the world. There was a great believer in the first century by the name of Saul of Tarsus. He was later known as Paul, and you're familiar with his writings. Paul said, whatever gain I had, I counted loss for Christ. Indeed, he says, I count all things as loss for the excellency of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. And he says, I have suffered the loss of all things and count them as but rubbish, that I might gain Christ and be found in him. And to the Colossians, he makes the statement that all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge are hid in Christ. And in chapter 2, in verse 10 of that book, he says, and you have come to fullness of life in him. That's what the Apostle Paul thought about Jesus Christ. He spoke of the presentation of the gospel as being something of which he was not ashamed. I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it's the power of God to salvation to everybody that believes it, to the Jew first and also to the Greek.
May I ask you very briefly this morning, what do you think about Jesus Christ? What's your opinion of Him? May I say that you cannot ignore Him if you believe in Him? Let's observe that Jesus is not being killed today by people who love Him, obviously. He's not being killed today by people who believe in Him. But He's also not being killed today by people who deny Him or despise Him. He's being killed today by those people who just simply ignore Him. But may I make the observation today that you cannot know Jesus Christ and ignore Him. His claims are too extreme. His demands are too severe. His credentials are too true. Everything about Him is that which lifts Him above the realm of the ordinary. You can know me and ignore me. We can ignore many of us in this congregation today. We can know you and ignore you. Because of the fact that most of us, it really doesn't make all that much difference whether we come or go, as far as the world scene is concerned. But that is not true with Jesus. You can't know Jesus and believe in Him and still ignore Him. Consequently, I've come to the conclusion that if a person believes in Jesus Christ, he is going to speak. Now, the good news about Jesus Christ is genuinely good news. The good news that God, in the person of Jesus, expressed His goodness and His loving kindness to us when we were sinners, when we were ungodly, when we were weak, while we were helpless. He came down and says to us, I love you like you are. I want you to be different, but I love you as you are, in spite of what you are. I want you to be mine. I want to live with you. I want you to be with me. And I'm going to accept you where you are. If you'll just trust in me, I'm going to take you home with me. We'll have the best time. We'll spend eternity together. I'll let you become like me in the meantime. He says, if you'll just trust in me and commit yourself to Jesus Christ. That's good news. And yet the extremity of His claims, the repercussions and the wide repercussions and the vibrations of His claims and of His demands on you and me, those things make the message difficult to speak at times. And it recalls those of us who are less convinced, it requires sometimes that we maybe not speak at all. And those who are more convinced find themselves sometimes hesitating because of this extreme nature of this message. And those who are most convinced often ponder before they speak. But the conclusion that I've had to come to is that you're going to speak about what you believe in. Consequently, when you see a fellow that will brave indignities, that will risk friendships, that will go and knock on doors and take the chance of somebody slamming that door in his face, cursing him for the very fact that they've disturbed them, you can rest assured that person believes in Jesus Christ. Now, such speaking as that cannot be commanded, nor can it be instructed, or can they be prepared for it by someone else teaching them. You can't command that kind of teaching. You can't command that kind of speaking. Now, let me give you an illustration of it. And I'm not saying when I say this that a person ought to go unprepared or that he ought to go unprepared or unauthorized. That's not what we're saying. But I am saying that the preparation and the motivation of that kind of speaking, it is of a different nature. It has a different ring to it. For example, in Matthew the 28th chapter, verses 18 through 20, we find the Great Commission, that which much of our preaching today centers around. The Great Commission simply says, go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all the things that I have commanded you, and lo, I'm with you always, even to the end of the earth, or the world, the age. Now, that's a command. Go into all the world and preach the gospel. But listen to me. Though that is a command, I'm also aware of the fact that that was not the propelling, commanding motivation of the first century. That's not what motivated those people to go out on a lifelong journey and a lifelong presentation of the gospel that would captivate them through their life in presenting the gospel to the world. That was not their motivation. You say the Great Commission wasn't their motivation? Absolutely not. These people had something more than that going for them. I'm convinced that it will not be the motivation that propels you and me today as 20th century Christians to go and preach the gospel. There's got to be more than that going for us. The Great Commission served nothing more than as a button to release an already stored up power. That's all it was. Just as there was no power, there is no power in an atomic bomb button. The bomb, the button doesn't have the power. The power is in the bomb. And yet the man that may very well one day release the power in the bomb today probably will do it through pushing a button. But the button doesn't contain the power. It's just the release for the bomb that contains the power. Matthew 28, 19 and 20 doesn't contain, as far as I'm concerned and as far as I can see in the New Testament, it doesn't contain any of the power. It merely was the release button that then released an already stored up power, and that stored up power was a burning faith in Jesus Christ. There's where the power was. Listen, Jesus Christ spent 3.5 years trying to convince those men of his identity. He spent 3.5 minutes. If you repeated the thing 6 times, he spent 3.5 minutes on the Great Commission. Today, what is the arrangement of our priorities? If we're not careful today, you and I in the church today will hear 3.5 years of preaching on the Great Commission and 3.5 minutes presentation on the identity of Jesus Christ. And then we wonder why it is that we have an immobilized, stagnating, unmustered, and unmotivated army of people who don't know which direction they ought to be going and don't have the power to propel them in that direction should they have known it. But I'm convinced that the reason is this. We've got our priorities backwards. The time ought to be when we'll spend 3.5 years convincing the disciples in the world, the disciples of the identity of Jesus. And then the only time that we'll need to spend on the Great Commission is just about 3.5 minutes to serve as a latch on a gate, which after 3.5 years of feeding and bringing those people to faith, that Great Commission just being flipped and the command, now get, and those horses that have been held up in that corral all those 3.5 years being fed and being developed, they'll come charging out of there with such force you couldn't stop them if you wanted to. That's the nature of the Great Commission and what it occupies in the New Testament. But not only that, Jesus' Great Commission to go can be appreciated really only if you put it in the context of his previous commission to stay. Are you aware of the fact that Jesus had his disciples work under a previous commission that commission said stay? In Matthew the 16th chapter and verse 20, Jesus says, "Don't tell anyone that I'm the Christ." Don't tell anyone that I'm the Christ. That's what he said. In Matthew 16, 20, he said, don't tell a soul. But you say, why, Lord? The men's faith, the disciples' faith had already come now to the place where Peter had back in verse 18 or verse 16. He just got through confessing that you were the Christ. That's right. And yet Jesus in verse 20 says, don't you tell a soul that I'm the Christ. Well, now why? Well, for one thing, the fact of his resurrection hadn't been made a reality. Let me give it to you in a bit different context. In the next chapter, chapter 17 of Matthew, verses 1 through 9, they saw something that I know must have absolutely turned them upon end. They were up in a mount with Jesus, and they saw him transfigured in an unearthly form and transformed into an unearthly figure. And as they came down out of the mountain, Jesus said, it says he commanded them, don't you tell this sight to anybody until the Son of Man has been raised. Well, now, why was it necessary to tell them that? You put yourself in their shoes. Put yourself in their shoes. You're up on the mountain with Peter and James, and here's Jesus and with John, and we're up there, and we see this thing, and it's something that nobody's ever seen before. Don't you know what frame of mind those men were in when they came down out of that mountain? Don't you know that Jesus Christ almost had to choke them and say, if you tell anybody about this, you won't ever hear the last of it? And that's why he said he commanded them. And back in verse 20 now, and just a few days before that, when Peter had confessed Jesus to be the Christ, it says he strictly charged them, don't you tell a soul that I'm the Christ. And it was because of the fact that the gospel, they didn't have anything to tell. His death and his burial and his resurrection, those things weren't facts yet. They weren't history. And these men were to be sent out to tell of something that had happened, not something that was going to happen. And he said, you must stay back. You must not go. And he kept them in for about 18 months until that which was the message of the gospel could be completed and made a reality. But not only was that true, not only was the message not ready, the men weren't ready. In verse 21, Jesus began to tell them how that he must go up to Jerusalem and there be treated shamefully by the rulers and there be killed and on the third day be raised. To show you that the men weren't ready, Simon Peter stopped the whole show, took him aside, and began to rebuke him and say, Lord, God forbid, this is never going to happen to you. And then Jesus said, oh, Satan, hush. Get behind me. In other words, shut up. You're on the side of men, not on God's side. You don't know what you're talking about. And though Simon Peter confessed Jesus as the Christ, Simon Peter didn't know what on earth the Christ was about. He knew Jesus was unusual. He knew Jesus had the qualities of the divine, but he didn't have a clue as to what the Christ's mission was. And that's why Christ couldn't send men like that out. They didn't know what the message meant. Had they had the message, they couldn't have explained it. And so he said, you're not ready yet. You're a hindrance to me. Now I want to ask you a question. Do you think it's possible that in the churches of Christ today, we have made a mistake in our methodology? I'm proposing that for a change, instead of going around preaching on the Great Commission, instead of going around and loading people with this sense of guilt because they haven't gone, I maintain that we stop for about 3.5 to 4 years and start letting us work under the similar restrictive commission that the disciples of Jesus worked under. What would you think about a man that would stand in a pulpit and tell a congregation of people, don't you tell a soul that Jesus is the Christ? Well, you'd think he had lost his mind. And yet that is precisely what the Lord told his own disciples, don't you say a word about it. Now, the message obviously is ready for today. He died 2,000 years ago and was raised. But I'll guarantee you, there are a lot of people being caused to feel guilty because they're not ready to go out with the message. And yet we've got men standing saying, you've got to go. You've got to go. You've got to go. Jesus would just as well have said to us, you've got to stay. Don't you tell a soul. Why? Because we're not ready. The kind of speaking that I'm talking about is that which comes like a teapot, either whistling or bursting. And you don't stand there and talk to a cold teapot about whistling. You turn the burner on under it. Neither do you stand and talk to a cold congregation about speaking. You turn the burner on. And when the time comes that we understand that principle, we'll come a whole lot nearer getting the gospel of Christ out. Because all true speaking depends on faith. Strong conviction has always been the key ingredient to strong communication. And you can't stop a man from communicating who is strongly convicted. And to those who are not strongly convicted, you don't have to worry about stopping them from communicating because their lack of conviction has already stopped their communication. And you know that as well as I do. Let me give you some Bible examples of it. Mark records two unusual situations, one in Mark 1 and one in Mark 7. In Mark 1, Jesus Christ healed a leper. And he told the man, he says, now see to it, and that's a strong expression, see to it. In other words, you make this your business, boy. See to it that you don't say anything to anybody about this, but go and offer the gift that Moses commanded you. But Mark says in verse 44 and 45, said, he went out and began to talk freely about it and to spread the news everywhere. But Jesus said, don't do that. Yeah, but how do you stop a leper from talking about being cleansed? In Mark 7, Jesus was going up in the metropolitan area across the Jordan River in the 10-city area, the Decapolis. And he met a man there who was deaf and had a speech impediment. And he healed him. And the people were watching him, and he commanded them, don't tell this to anybody. But then Mark records that the more he charged them, the more they told it. so that he couldn't even go into the cities anymore. He had to wait out in the valleys, and all the people had to come to him. Well, now, what's that saying? I don't doubt but what Jesus, when he saw these people and saw the leper and saw, I don't doubt but what he just simply shook his head and grinned. Because he knew they couldn't hold it back in too. He was trying to keep his ministry on an even keel. He didn't want to get the thing revved up too fast. And he said, now keep it quiet. Well, they couldn't any more keep it quiet than a tea kettle could keep quiet with a burner under it. They had heard something. They had seen something. They had experienced something. And they just simply actually disobeyed the Lord. That's right. Jeremiah, it calls to my mind his situation. Back in Jeremiah 21, Jeremiah said, if I say, I'll just not mention him or speak any more in his name. Now, he'd been getting a lot of flack from what he'd been saying. People were kicking him. They were abusing him. They were ridiculing. They were making songs up about him. And he gotten so discouraged, he just said, well, I just won't say anything more in his name. I'm not going to mention him anymore. But he said, if I say that, there is within me, in my heart, as though it were a burning fire shut up in my bones. And I'm weary from holding it in, and I can't hold it any longer. He said, I've got to tell it. In Acts, the 4th chapter, the writer there records the statement by Simon Peter when those people of the Jerusalem leaders said, we strictly charged you not to speak in this man's name anymore, and here you have filled Jerusalem with this teaching. Peter said, we can't help it. He said, we cannot help but speak what we've seen and heard. He says, it's beyond us. I can't help it. I'm going to have to talk about it. That's what the writer Paul meant when he quoted an Old Testament passage and says, we have the same spirit of faith as he who said, I believed and therefore I spoke. He says, we also believe and therefore we speak. And that's just as natural as you can get. You can't get it any better than that. You're going to speak about what you believe. All real genuine speaking comes from genuine conviction. In Acts, the 8th chapter, verses 4 and 5, it says, those that were scattered abroad went about gossiping the gospel, gossiping the word. The word there is used, it's preaching as it's translated. But then the next verse, in verse 5, says, and Philip went down to Samaria and proclaimed to them the Christ. One of these indicates more or less a classical proclamation. That was done by Philip as a classical public speaker. But the one that's used in verse 4 is a less classical term than that. Is not nearly so uppity in the sense of being classical, but it's more koine, and it more or less, and was translated by one man as being, they went everywhere gossiping the gospel, over the back fence, over a cup of tea, over the dinner table, over the clothesline, in the homes, wherever they were. They just talked about the gospel. They talked about the good news. Why? Because they believed it. You can't stop it. Now let me give you one present day example and then a present day opportunity. In 1969, I heard Richard Wurmbrand of Romania speak at Christ Church New Zealand. He told about his 14 years of being in prison because of his conviction that Jesus of Nazareth was the Son of God. 14 years! The first 3 years were 3 years of solitary confinement. He saw nobody but his oppressors and the communist people who oppressed him. He was in there because he believed and because he was preaching Jesus Christ. He was a very outstanding man in this country. He was first arrested in 1948. And through 1951, the man was incarcerated in prison in solitary confinement. He was released. He was put back in prison. He spent in all about 14 solid years in prison because he believed that Jesus of Nazareth was what he claimed to be. Listen to what that man did. He was put there because he believed. Do you think that shut him up? No. Those men devised a plan. He figured out there was a heating system or a piping system that ran all the way through there, water pipes or heating pipes. And he devised a Morse code. And all during the day and night, there was this peculiar tapping on the pipes. Why? He was telling people about his Lord. What in the world would make a man do that? What do you think would make him do it? There's not but one thing. He believes it. He believes it. Now let me show you something. A present day opportunity. You can be thrown in a cell if you'd like. You can be thrown in a cell. We're going to arrange it where you will be thrown into a cell yourself. It's a bit reversed. we're going to throw you in a cell because we're not preaching the gospel, okay? We're going to throw you in a cell because you're not preaching the gospel. Now, this is not a blanket indictment of the whole church. It's just a general indictment of many of us in the church. This, you've been wondering, what in the world is that chart for? One of the men said last night, he said, that's the most bodacious outline I've ever seen of a sermon. I said, wait till you see me get to point 15. But look, this is our zone program as it's outlined. These lines and the numbers show the zones. The 10 red marks there with the names out beside it, that's the statement of where these life sessions are meeting. And there are little cells all over this city, 15 of them. 15 cells all over the city that are prepared not by the communists, but they're endorsed by our elders. And they're being led by various evangelists and men in the congregation. They're being prepared not for people who've been out here preaching the gospel and have been warned to stop it. They've been prepared by people who've been prepared to preach the gospel but now never have started it. So you're going to be having an opportunity to be thrown into one of these cells. Now let me ask you a question. If Richard Wurmbrand can be put in jail by the communists because he preached the gospel and he couldn't be stopped, even when he was put in jail, he figured out a way to get it through Morse code. May I ask you, what in the name of common sense would be the difference between us not having taken it, then being thrown into a cell, and still not tell it? You know what the difference is? The difference is faith. You're going to tell what you believe. Now, these 15 life session groups, these 15 cells that are meeting, they're meeting so that you can have a supportive group. You're going to be thrown in there with about 15 other prisoners. But they're not people who are unrelated to Christ. They're people who are Christians. They're not going to be looking down on you. They're going to be encouraging you. So you're being given an opportunity to get over in one of these cells and learn how to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ while it's being done. You're learning how to do it. And that's what we're trying to do. There are many who have a faith, but it isn't sufficient to make them speak because maybe they're not prepared. This is an effort to further prepare you. For 4 years now, I've been preaching on evidences that would present and produce faith in your life, faith in Jesus Christ. I wasn't all that concerned that for 4 years there wasn't much outreach into this community. I knew full well that before we can go in a genuine way, it'll have to be an outreach that is produced through faith. But 4 years, I don't know whether you were content to do it, but I was content. Knowing that Jesus spent 3.5 years with his own disciples, I figured I was at least 6 months behind my own Lord. And it would take me at least 6 months more to get us prepared, ready to go out and preach the gospel. But now listen, if we're not ready now, and if this crutch that we're going to be using, these life sessions, if that doesn't provide us with an additional help to implement this proclamation of the gospel, if we don't see an ever-increasing outreach into the community and into the world that we ourselves are doing because of each one of us in his own way and to the degree that his own talent presents him with the facilities and the faculties to present his faith, if we don't see an ever-increasing involvement of members of this body of people into this community, do you know what is the only conclusion that I'll be able to come to? And I'm afraid that history will write down as the characteristic of this church. History will have to say, well, the people just didn't believe. They didn't believe. Now, I'm not saying this to discourage you. I think we're right on the verge of bursting forth. It's already happening. And these 15 groups, and they're not in any one zone or any 15 zone, they're just all through it. Find out if you'd like to be a part of it. If you don't feel quite like you can go out on your own, if you're not ready to do this Morse code bit, would you be able then to get into a group of people who are being led by a leader to go out into the community? Would you be able and willing to go into that and be further trained so that you might yourself develop so that you can tell people about what you believe about Jesus? Would you do that? Now, they're already full right now. You're too late to get in on these 15. But just sit there and chew and chomp, get ready, because in about 2 or 3 months, it's going to be offered again. And by that time, we ought to have 45 groups meeting in this city. When that time comes, by the way, that we go forth gossiping the gospel like they did in the first century, you're going to see the same thing happen today that happened in the first century. But I'll guarantee you, it won't be because of some evangelist standing in the pulpit preaching it from one location. It'll have to be done all over this city. And it won't be done by some evangelist standing here making you feel guilty for not doing it when you're not prepared to do it. The only thing on God's earth that's going to cause the gospel to be preached to the God's earth is that of a very deep, burning conviction that Jesus of Nazareth is the Son of God. And when that happens, you're going to speak it. And to the degree that it happens, to that degree we're going to speak it. That's as pure and simple as I can put it. Now, God bless you, and let's make sure that look into your heart, see if your faith is growing, and if it's growing and you need a way to begin expressing it, here's one good opportunity for you, and I hope and pray that you'll take advantage of it. We're going to sing a song, "If the Name of the Savior is Precious to You, Will You Not Tell It Today?" And we're going to let that be our song of encouragement while we stand and sing.
If His care has been constant and tender and true, if the light of His presence